Yo.
Oh, it's that
Bobby, Ricky. Oh, styling out.
Yellow today. Man, like, I haven't put this hat's like 15 years old. Found it.
Yo, man. You styling like nobody else. Like slick Rick status. The rule. All right, everybody. Welcome to another Giving Flowers to Wednesday. Today, and the Supreme Hall of Famer, through his titanic style and progressive contribution to freeskiing, quality over quantity fits the man well, I'd say. Through his short 6-year career, his impact is like his body size, colossal. Who else do we have now to introduce to our fourth episode of Giving Flowers to then Philou Poirier?
Ladies Booyah. And
gentlemen, clap, scream, jump.
Bullet, till who?
Make some noise. We're going to get him on.
I'm going to roll a spliff. Has to
say.
Oh, yes.
Been years.
You know what I just realized, Philou? I just realized this is our fourth show, and you're the fourth Phil, and I'm fucking stoked.
Woo!
Adam,
yeah, Philou.
Just like the fourth Phil.
Oh, I've been waiting for this one. It's been a long time, buddy.
Guys. You guys hear me okay?
Yeah, now you're good to go in the Perfect. Shop. I see.
Yes, sir.
Business
look at Iberg all styling.
For you, my friend.
Yellow, Easter yellow for the spring. I like it.
And it was Orthodox Easter, I believe, on Monday.
How you been, guys?
Awesome. How have you been, Philou?
Really good, man.
Do you know why Phil asked you to come and talk with us?
I don't know. You guys are reaching the bottom of the list and you needed someone, or...
It's not true at all. So what Phil and I always talk about skiing because he's whatever, that's our link. And he's making cartoons. I'm working on some pet stuff. And once said and done, our bond is skiing. So we're like, fuck, man, why not just go live? And the reason why we did is like, you know what? I was like, man, let's celebrate the people that made our sport fucking dope. Like, we're still talking about it. I'm here in Minnesota. I'm not doing anything in skiing in the last 6 years, but it's that awesome. So we went through and we're like, man, let's just like, have you ever seen Drink Champs?
Nope.
So it's a podcast pretty much just about giving legend rappers and icons like a platform to give them their flowers and tell them how dope they are. So I was like, Phil, do you want to start something where we call legends and tell them how dope they are? So the reason why we asked you to be on this show is to tell you how fucking dope you are and give thanks everything you did in skiing. That's why we're here.
That's great, man. Thanks for having me, man. I'm very flattered, actually.
Well, it's pretty good too, man. We're so happy that you're on, man. And for myself personally, you were my first, and probably I told you this before, but you were my first idol, inspiration. Your segment, which I was playing right now, that got cut off from the game, changed my life and really set me on the path and that I am on today. As far as like music influence, style influence, it hit all the chord in me. And I was trying to do what you did and never could.
Oh, yes, you did, man. You succeeded at it, man. I've known you for a long time, Phil. And to this day, you're still one of my favorite guys to look because like you guys mentioned, I always loved to bring something new to the sport. And, you know, the older the sport grew, it was harder and harder to do that. And to this day, when I look at your little segments and all the little film that you do, you always find a way to bring something new to the table, which I really enjoy because there's a lot of copycats out there, man.
You can't even copy Phil number 15, man. He's like the sickest Phil.
Thank you so much, Phil, for this kind work. So for the people who aren't familiar, let's get a background about where you grew up and how you got into skiing.
Grew up in, I was born in Saint-Jérôme, which is about, 45 minutes north of Montreal. And my parents always had a cottage up here in Tremblant, which is another 45 minutes north from Saint-Jérôme. So I literally learned to ski on the Tremblant Hills when I was a kid. And I still live here, actually. But I've never been really part of any mogul skiing. It's always been kind of like free skiing for me since day one, because I loved hockey, and I was playing hockey in the morning, usually the weekends, and then I would move to the hill after and do skiing in the afternoon. So since every skiing clubs or competitions or anything like that was in the morning, I chose hockey on top of that, on instead of a competitive skiing. So
I have a question for you, Flew, because I'm gonna fan out and ask you stuff because we're friends and I don't know so many things. So when you're like, because you're 2 years older than me, yeah, and it's mid-90s and you're not part of a team or organization and you skate hockey in the morning, who's your crew? Like, who? Because normally in Minnesota, my friends that ice skated definitely weren't skiing,
yeah,
or snowboarding.
I mean, I've always been part of like two different gangs, because I was hanging out with the skateboarders a lot, which had, kind of like an influence on me, because they were snowboarders in the winter and I was the only skier, but I could still hang out and ride with them on the hill. Then, the hockey guys were definitely not skiers, because these guys were, most of them had parents that really wanted to become like pro hockey players and stuff. So they really pushed when they weren't, playing hockey. They'd go out on the rink outside and play some more. And I like to, keep it differently. I like to play different sports, and it's always been like that. Like, I have to keep it entertaining, or else I have the tendency to get bored, and so I got to switch it up pretty often. So yeah, the snowboarders definitely had a big impact on me. All my snowboarder skateboarding friends, and the other guys that I played hockey with, I didn't really hang out with them. It was more I see them at the rink and that's it,
Yeah.
How did you get a pass through the forbidden skier park? Because back then when you started, skiers were forbidden to be in the park. Yeah, you say you have a lot of snowboard homies, but still, how do you make it through and not get beef with ski patrol and such and such?
Yeah, that's interesting, man, because I remember I was just talking about that I was skiing with my kid, and I showed my daughter, who's just turned 6 years old, I showed her the exact spot where I learned my first 360 when I was 8 years old. I did it by myself, just trying over and over. It took me about 3 to 4 tries to get it. But I remember it was a very remote place that had a little side hill kicker that was hidden. And I remember I was more scared of getting caught by the ski patrol than to actually try the trick. And I did, when I first started to do 360, after that, I was doing it everywhere, every bump that I could see. And I got stopped by a ski patrol. I was, maybe 9 years old. And the guy actually took my pass away because he said I wasn't allowed to jump. And I was skiing by myself. So I started crying because I thought my dad was going to beat me up because he would have to buy me a new pass. I didn't know how it worked. So I went to the ski patrol. I was scared. I felt like I was walking in the police station telling them that I committed a crime. So they gave me, after arguing and stuff, they gave me my pass back. But that's how it was back then. Like, as soon as you got off the ground, you were, you could lose your ticket or your pass. So I changed a lot through the years. But moving to the train park was the only place that you could actually go and hit jumps in a legal manner. So it was forbidden to skier. So I wasn't allowed to go in there. But most of the hardcore snowboard guys were my good friends. So they always let me in the park. But I had to sneak in under a fence, hit the jump, and then come back out because the ski patrol would wait. It would be on top at the entrance and at the bottom. So you could sneak your way in and still not get caught, but it was a pain in the ass. Like, I couldn't believe like that it was actually snowboarders only that were allowed to hit the jump. So I kind of like did that for one season, and then it became a little more open. Snowboarders were accepting skiers, but I was basically the only skier in the park back then. So in Tremblant, there was no one else. There's, you know, some guys sometimes I would come and hit the jump, but it'd get snowballed.
So there was no like mogul skiers at that resort. That
not really. Tremblant's always been like, I don't know. Like it might be stereotype, but it was like the kind of like the rich man ski hill where people, most of the kids were doing ski racing, and you know,
okay, it's like spring break
for 5 pair of skis that they could, you know, and like it was a different vibe. And then all the guys that were more like me were snowboarders that, you know, kind of like caused trouble on the hill, and then we were like, you know, like the skid rows of the mountain. But it wasn't a very, very popular ski resort for young guys that didn't have that much money to spend on, you know, ski tickets were more expensive and everything was more expensive. So that created like a natural filter for guys like us. Like we managed to find a way to get passes. Some of us were like, snowboarders were helping building the park to get a free pass and stuff like that. And it's, I was working in a bar, so I could afford to buy my season pass. I was making pretty good money there. So I was able to buy my season pass every year, but it took a while before I actually got a free pass because I was a decent skier, you know?
So were you a ski bum when you graduated high school and just skied and bartend?
Pretty much, yeah. You did? Pretty much. I moved to Tremblant. Like, I did 2 years in Cégep, which is transition between high school and university. You do 2 years, usually three, depending on what you're studying. And I literally went there because the basketball coach approached me and said he wanted me on the team. So he's like, just find something that you can do within school and then come play basketball for me. And I was like, all right.
I'm so tall.
I went to school, but then my grades were so bad that I got kicked out after a year and a half. So I didn't finish that. But I moved to Tremblant after that. And the only way I could ski was to find a job that would, you know, that would be at night. So bartending was perfect, or restaurants. Like, I started in a restaurant as a busboy because I could work from, you know, 5 to 12 and then, you know, go and party at the Caribou and wake up and then ski all day if I wanted to. So and it was also good money coming out of, you know, coming out of school just to be able to make quick tip money and then, you know, just hang out and go out to the bars. And that was literally my lifestyle. And I had dreams of, you know, making it somehow in the ski business, but it was really hard back then. You know, you had
Glenn. So here's, I want to get to this quick because it's 97 now and you're 19 years old.
Yeah.
And you're 2 years like, just got out of school, you're kind of ski bumming. In 97, there's no sport yet, right?
No.
Like, even that fall State of Mind by Poor Boys came out.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Like, the Phils are up doing their thing. Mogul skiers are doing their thing on the side of the competition. Like, so is it even a thought? Like, because there's pro snowboarders. There's pro skateboarders in 97. Yeah. But do you even think, like, skiing is an option as a...
I was trying to, you know, to figure out how we could, because the guys who were getting paid were big mountain skiers back then, you know, like,
yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, Seth Morrison, Brad Holmes, Kreitler, all these guys were, you know, kind of making money doing flips off cliffs, skiing powder, which was kind of hard for East Coaster. But I figured that if I could make enough money and move out west, I could probably do that, because it was, for me, landing in powder was like,
not landing on ice.
It's going to be easy, you know.
Yeah. Back, you can land on your head and not die.
How hard can it be, you know? At first, like, you're all like, you know, it's going to be a piece of cake. So, but other than that, I knew Vinny. I knew Vinny and Cusson from Vinny was his parents knew my parents. So I knew Vinny from like early days of like high school. So
okay, so were you familiar then that like he was doing anything as far as grabbing and stuff with Tucson?
Because I saw him sometimes on the ski hill, and I know these guys were doing 360s and started to grab their skis, and you know I kind of did that a little bit too, and I remember, you know, Hostness and these guys were doing grabs in the magazines and stuff, and it quickly became a direction that I wanted my skiing to take. And after the boys went to the X Games, like I was kind of like on the side all the time. These guys were like a little bit in the focus because they were on the national team. They got, you know, they had the lights on them already a little bit, but I was more like hidden on the side. But I was always, you know, always there to learning the new tricks that these guys were doing, and I just never had the camera or anything on me. And I went to Whistler one spring. These guys were there: JF, Vinny, JP, Shane, and they were shooting with Johnny in the train park on Blackcomb. And I remember they were shooting in the pipe, and these guys were doing airs and nothing crazy, but you know, like pretty cool stuff.
This is before 13. This
that is was before you 13. Won the... that was for okay. that was Degenerates. Probably Degenerate State of Mind. I don't even know if it was a real project, but Johnny was out there with the camera, and I remember dropping in the pipe and I did a flare, and Johnny came to me and said, "Hey dude, that was pretty cool. You know, you think you could do it again?" I was like, "Yeah, sure, I'll do it again." I went back up and did a bunch of them, and he filmed me, but he never used the footage because he was really just shooting the boys that were there. So that was the first time that I encountered Johnny. And that was the first time that I actually got into like a kind of like a film shoot. And then I went back home and kept doing my things. And then JF and JP and Vinny came to the World Cup here in Tremblant. I believe it was 98.
Yeah.
And I already had a pair of the 1080 because the guy who owned the Caribou used to work for Salomon.
Okay.
And he was good friends with the Canadian team manager. So he got me hooked up pretty quick before the guys didn't even know that I was kind of like on the program, but I had boots, I had the bindings and skis. And at the beginning of that year, when Saint-Sauveur opened, Saint-Sauveur is always the first hill to open. So I went there, I had my gear. I was like, fuck, I got twin tips now. You know, it's a game changer. And I remember taking a chair up with JP because JP was there. He visited Vinny and they skied together. And I took a chair with him. And he was like, "Hey, man, how did you get those skis?" I was like, "Well, someone gave them to me." He looked at me and said, "That's cool, man."
He's probably like, "Fuck, man, we've been working for a year or two to get those. Who's this guy?"
I could see that there was a little bit of
what the fuck is going on?
Joke on it, but JP was so, you know, he was so nice. He couldn't be mean to anyone, but you could tell when he wasn't too happy about something that he didn't have his grasp on, or he didn't have his word to say, you know, especially then, because
that was the biggest thing he had his hands in, that he didn't know what was going on.
You had yellow skis back then, man, you were the shit. So, and then I skied with JP that day, and we, it's funny because that's early days, like 98, like fall. So it would be it was fall 98, exactly. And JP and I were challenging each other at doing 360s both directions back then. And JP's like, "Yeah, you can do it, Lex, and you do it right."
What did you guys call, what did you call, what was your unnatural called? We called them dark side.
Yeah, I can't remember what we called it, but it became unnatural, obviously. But
yeah.
I never really liked that term because to me, from the beginning, I wanted skiers to get rid of that name and be like, it doesn't have to be unnatural. It should.
Oh, we're going to get there with back-to-back nines.
Yeah, you proved it. I pushed really hard trying to get left side and right side from the early days. I was like, it should be left side, right side. It doesn't need to be an unnatural way. And it got, you know, pretty big arguments with some Tahoe boys, I remember, with PR, and these guys are like, no, you know, it's not your natural way to do it. And
it's so fun because is it natural to slide on a rail? Is it natural to put skis on your feet and go down a mountain? Nothing. Everything's kind of unnatural when you think about it.
That's true, man. But yeah, no, I wanted it to be from day one. I wanted skiers to be able to spin both directions. I for me, it was really important. If you look, at my segments back then, you'll notice that I do stuff like both directions from early days, and
you and Rex Thomas, man.
Yeah, always try to push the direction that to give more opportunity and more possibilities on tricks. Obviously, that open a brand new possibilities, and then just spinning on one direction, you know. And now it's cool because you see it now. Guys are doing crazy tricks both directions, which to me is out of the world now, because it seems so crazy to be spinning double flips, triple flips on the right side and doing three, four spins. It's crazy.
Crazy.
And from then, like 98, you meet GP, Vinny, you're kind of inducted to the whole freesky scene, and then 99.
Yeah,
you get to start filming your first video part with
Voice Production. It actually started in 99. I was trying to figure out a way to be able to compete against those guys, because, you know, it was a very closed circuit. You know, you had the X Games, but the first X Games were invites only, and I wanted to be, you know, I did some local competitions with the Phils that came up to Tremblant and stuff like that. But I knew I had some stuff that I could do to compete against the big boys, but there was windows of opportunity. So 99 US Open was the only competition that you could register it, and everybody could show up and just, you know, try to take, there you go. That's the shot right there. That was the 99 podium. If you could go to US Open, register, and if you did well, you could, you know, you could compete against the big boys and make a name for yourself. So I gathered all my money. My dad helped me out with a plane ticket, and I took the plane to Vail, and they lost all my luggage at the airport for all my boots, and I showed up in Vail with no gears at all. So and that was a big bummer for me, and I was ready to quit, because I tried to call the company. No one knew where my bags were. I talked to the Salomon guys, which was Dano back then, and he didn't have the boot size that I needed, and everything went south, and I was like, all right, that's it, you know, I won't be able to compete. And I got on a real bender with Lubeck that night in Vail, which was the first time I met him. And got really hammered with them. And then I went to my hotel and kind of like shut my eyes a few hours, because I was expecting the shuttle to bring my equipment, and nothing showed up. And I got up that morning and I went and I said, you know what, I made it all this way here. I'm not going to let that little event just stopped me from competing. So I went to the rental boot place and I got some rental boots, and then they gave me a pair of Salomon 1080 demo with the demo binding set up. And
no way, they even had demo, because yeah, man, that was yeah. crazy to even get those skis at the time. Yeah. They had demos.
Dano had two pairs, like the 177 and a pair of 167, I believe the other side said, on the demo binding. So I got those. And went up to my team, did my qualifying run, qualified for the grand finale at night. And I did a cork 9 for my first jump for qualifiers, and qualified first. And then for the final jump, I was going to do the same trick. JP is like, dude, everybody's been talking about that switch backflip of yours.
Yeah, wait. Let's go back before, learning the switch backflip. So you're learning something that's never been done before, and that's a month before the event.
Yeah.
I need to ask quick. Wait, I need to ask. Did you see anyone do it when you were learning it? Because I know is that JF did it in the credits of Degenerates.
No, man, that's the thing, you know, because I never saw that trick done before, and I didn't know JF well enough to ask him about it. And all I remember is that I was skiing in Tremblant, and then for some reason I was like, it's totally possible to do a full backflip going backward and land backward. And I just visualized it for, like, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. Every time I was in my bed, man, I'd close my eyes and I could I would go over and look over my right shoulder and then go completely blind and then just huck it. And I could visualize the whole move in my head. I figured, you know, it was going to be easy because it felt like I've already done it the way I was visualizing it. And I told my friend, when I left for, when I was at the top of the start, and I told the guys, like, all right, I'm trying something new here, guys. If you don't see me ski out of it, come see me because things could go south. So, I remember taking off and I came in the jump and it was a pretty decent booter that we had. It was like 45 foot tabletop, you know, 50 feet to the landing, to the landing spot. And I went in, I was scared. Talking to you guys, I still remember the feeling when I put my head back and huck it. And as soon as I saw the landing coming around and put my skis and I greased it perfectly the first try. And the guys skied down and snowboarders came to see me and jumped on me and they were like, oh my God. And my friend's like, dude, he's like, I thought you were committing suicide when I saw you take off.
It was nuts. I was on the knoll, man. And I never seen nothing like it.
Yeah. And I got it perfectly. And I was like, right after that, the day after, I learned switch rodeo as well because I figured it was different position. But I was so stoked about landing the switch backflip that it gave me a lot of confidence. So I did the switch underflip kind of thing.
Yeah.
And showed up to Vail having those two tricks in my bag that I knew, you know, probably no one was doing back at that time. And so in the qualifier of the slope style, in because that's the way it worked at the U.S. Open, you had the slope style qualifier, and then they would pick a certain amount of guys for the big air at night. So it was the same day, slope style in the morning, big air at night, and didn't do the trick in the qualifier because I wanted to, you know, just to save. And I figured I didn't need that to qualify. And when I did the 900 in the finals qualifier, I was going to do that again because that's what JF told me to do. He's like, dude, do it again. It was super clean. And I was like, yeah. He's like, and JP's like, no, dude, you're kidding me? If you have the switch backflip, you got to do that, man. It's going to blow everybody in. Wait. So I was like, all right, I'll do the switch backflip. And I went down and did the switch. There we go. That's the picture. That's the shot right there. And, I remember Johnny Mosey was the announcer. He came to me and everybody when I landed the switch backflip. I thought I was too big at first because I was coming in with a lot of speed. And kind of landed at the bottom. When I spotted the landing, I could see everybody else's landing spot. And I was like still in the air. So I was like, oh my God, this is going to be hard. And remember, I'm on demo binding still. So
and let's remember, you're 6'4", 220 pounds.
Yeah, so I was kind of scared that the bindings would blow up on me, but I landed perfectly, and then everybody kind of like jumped on me and said, "Dude, like this is next level," and it's that's where it all began for me from that day. Actually, after that, Johnny came to see me and said, "You know, I want you in my movie," and Salman's like, "Let's get you on the program, the official program," and then Lionel and all the French boys signed me on a contract, and that's where it began that night.
So, a quick fun question: so, were you, other than JF, if we're super freaks that love the history, like doing it the year before? Like, did you do yours before McConkey?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I showed McConkey to do a switch backflip.
Because I just remember how stoked he was the next year on Marc Andre. He's like, "What? You do the sickest switch front flip?" And so I never knew your story.
Yeah, because actually that year in 99, we went in the spring, we went to the Super Park in Mammoth. And that's the first time I met Shane McConkey. And I was starstruck, man. He was like one of my idol from way back. And his mom was there. And he introduced me to his mom, and I wish I could still have the camera because I had an old handy cam that I brought there to film some footage of like all the boys because Blake was there as well.
Wayne, that was the first time I met him in my life, man. Yeah. First time on a motorcycle.
I was so stoked. It was crazy. But Shane McConkey came to see me and he said, "Hey, I want you to come in the small park with me because I want you to teach me how to do a switch backflip." And I was like, "Dude,
yes, sir.
Got it." No problem. So I went and saw and went in the park, in the Mammoth Park with him, and did a couple on like a 25-foot tabletop just to show him how to huck it and how to do it. And then he ended up doing a couple. And then we went back to the super park. And then Mikaki's like, I want you to switch back that jump down there. And I was like, all right. It was like the, I can't remember what they called it, the interceptor or something like that. It was like a 65-foot tabletop, pretty big.
Yeah.
And windy as Mammoth is always, you know. And Mikaki kind of like challenged me to do it. And then I ended up.
Wait, was this the monster jump that he overshot?
No, that wasn't that one. It was it was a pretty big jump, but it wasn't that big jump that him and.
I forgot they named every jump. You just brought it back to my head. Every jump had some nickname.
They had a name for every jump. So I did a switch back off that jump. That was the biggest one I've ever done. So it's. You know, like after that, I talking to JF, he's like, yeah, I did one off kind of like a mogul kicker. And I was like, all right, you know, I think time wise, JF did it before me for sure. But I was definitely the first one to do it off of like a real jump. And in competition as well. But, you know, back then we didn't have the internet. So it wasn't for me, it wasn't possible to know that JF had done one in Japan, and that
and you had to be such a fan. Like, I watched Degenerates a million times and would watch till through the credits. So I mean, me as the like loving this, like, it's very rare. That's why I wanted to like ask you and figure out the timeline in that 1 year time period from JF to you to McConkie. I mean there's a million new tricks every day, so it's kind of fun to figure it out.
Picked up like those years, the first 3 years after that were. Every time we were out, there was someone trying something new, you know, and that's for me, that was really important. That's something that always kept me interested, was to try something new. What's the next new thing that we could do, you know, not simply adding a 180 or a 360 to a trick, but what can we do that's never been done, or how can we do something different, you know, that's going to keep the sport fresh. And that's kind of like, one of the reasons where I lost interest and I sort of faded away is like I wasn't able to do that anymore. Like, I wasn't able to come up with new things. And, you know, that mixed up with a few injuries was definitely one of the reasons why I kind of like drifted out of the game, you know.
So here's one of my next questions. That's where I'm first. Oh, go ahead, Phil.
How much credit do you owe to the Spider-Man figurine for the switch backflip?
You know, that was JP's Spider-Man, you know? JP would carry that with him and try to figure out tricks all the time. And we'd play with him and try to figure out different position in the air. And we would move it. So if you take it off axis, would it ever come back to his feet if you keep the axe? You know, it was funny, but it was our way to... kind of figure out some of the tricks that we were trying the next day or the same day.
Turpin did that too with popsicle sticks, and so did Kai when he was really little. And it's like, dude, man, they always had their popsicle stick G.I. Joe guy. And I was like, you guys are fucking awesome.
Yeah, whatever works, man. Whatever helps you figure out what's next, you know?
So here's my quick question on more first stuff. You know, it's hard to say people are first to do anything, but like, you were the first guy I ever saw documented or doing hand plants. Like, did you ever see anyone on skis do a hand plant where you're like, that was sick and intentional and I want to do that? Or was it something you did because of skateboarding?
I know. Well, I could do it. I could do it off a pretty big quarter pipe on my skateboard back then. And you know what? JP is probably the first one that got one documented, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Because I did it. It was pretty much at the same time, because we were trying it together, and he did one in Whistler, and I was doing it with him, and he got the one. He got the camera shot, but mine wasn't dialed. I didn't want it in the movie. But after that, I did probably 60 of them for O'Connell for that Oakley poster,
which was dope.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, and I got some credit too that I thought was very, very flattering from Therrier, because he was a big fan of the hand plant on the snowboard. And when I first met him at the X game, he said, are you the kid that does the Oakley poster with the hand plant? And I was like, yeah. He's like, that's a dope shot. And I was, you know, Therrier for me was definitely some a idol to my friend snowboarders, but it, to me as well, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah, that was a cool shot. O'Connell made me go up and every time, like, go back up, do one more. And I did some mutes, I did some safety, I did.
I'd say it's the most iconic image in your career.
Probably.
Like, as far as a still image.
The angle that he took it and everything was so, so nice that, you know, I think it's definitely something that, that's to this day, every time I walk by my poster and I look at it, I'm like, oh man, that was such a cool shot.
Yeah, I think so too. Phil, around Phil.
Years, the game now we're moving to, you had a song from Cypress Hill, Rock Superstar.
Yeah.
And in the intro, you're talking about that skiing's your job and it's definitely like something you love.
Yeah.
Don't get it twisted. There's a lot of work that goes behind putting together a segment, which is kind of like also relative to the song, sort of. It ties into the song really well. I was wondering, did you have a choice in making did you have a say in making the choice for the song that you're in the game?
Yeah, I actually built the segment with Johnny from scratch with him. I wanted that song because I really liked the intro, what they were saying, and I could relate to what we were doing in a way. And it was a popular song back then too, so you know it was
don't play the audio, Phil, they'll disconnect the feed.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I know.
So and that was something too back then, we poached songs, like we didn't care. We
did he though popular. Did Johnny poach it? Because that was my only question, how much did that shit cost?
No, we didn't buy it, we poached it.
Nice work, Johnny, I'm proud of him.
Yeah, but he was really concerned, like he was. But the thing is, I went to California for at Johnny's place in Manhattan Beach to build that setup with that segment with him. And every time, like every shot that we put in and mixed it and try to time it with the song, we were like, Johnny was always like, oh, fuck, I hope they let me use that song. I hope they let me use that song because that segment's going to be great. And I was like, we're using that song no matter what, dude. I was like, I don't care.
Cease and desist is fine.
And yeah, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the internet to really pick up like song lyrics and stuff and be like, hey, this is that song. It's not, you know, it's not legally purchased. You can't use it. So you'd have to have someone related to Cypress Hill that kind of like watch a ski movie. So the odds were pretty small, you know?
Yeah.
So, we took that song and built that segment from scratch. And, it turned out to be every time I watch that segment, I like how everything is linked with the song and look over your shoulder. And you know, I'm like, I'm going backward and the spin-off angle on the rail. And
you know that backflip tail grab 180 you just did? You could do a backflip tail zero and then fucking revert it like a whip nowadays.
You know, like that's what Phil and these boys are doing. That freaks me out, man. I look at Vincent Gagné and Phil and all those revert fucking pretzel, call it whatever you want. It's out of this. It's like against the grain, man. It's so crazy. I really dig it, though.
Me too.
It's cool.
Phil's so fun. See, the fun part, too, is like before we talk to people, I just go and watch everything, and so does Phil. And then Phil reads about stuff, and then I just pull up memories in my head. Yeah. And this is fucking awesome, man. I get to see so many shots of mine. There, your knee blown. I watched that shot. Go back one shot, Phil. I watched that shot like a million times. I'm like, how is his knee not blown? How is his knee not blown?
This and, you one. Know, this competition was funny story because that was in Vermont for the X Games. And they canceled the Big Air they relocated the Big Air because Shane Anderson overshot the jump and broke his back. And I remember I was pissed because I told the guys, I was like, it's too windy to jump here, guys. It's not safe, blah, blah, blah. And all the boys were like, come on, you pussy. And I remember because in the practice, I was one of the first ones to hit the jump, and I was going to guinea the jump with a 360 and ended up doing a 540 all the way to the bottom of the landing. And I was like,
oh, yeah, it was a tailwind.
The wind really carried me on that one. I went back up and I was like, guys, careful. There's gusts on the takeoff and it'll take you down the hill. And I remember because Anderson actually thought twice about going. He went and did a backflip and went way too big to his back and got hurt. And then after that, they decided to relocate the bigger to the slope style bottom jump, which was hidden in a bit of a valley, but it was definitely a small jump. And for me to do a 900 on that jump, I had to take it all the way down to the bottom of the landing. And it's that shot that you see me almost blew my knee, but it's, I think I ended up fifth or sixth for the big air, but, it was very sad that, you know, they had to wait for an injury to call the move and to call the transfer to the other court.
And around those years, then after your segment in the game, you get invited to the Warrens Miller 50th movie shoot in Breckenridge.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, was taking the leap from filming from a core freaky movie like PvP to something with more mass appeal, like Warren Miller, a tough decision to make?
Well, for me, it's watching Warren Miller since I was a kid was, you know, like, was definitely something I wanted to do. And I was, you know, I didn't really enjoy the fact that he was just using what we were doing to keep his movies up to date, because he was kind of like losing ground with all the goofy stuff and all the things that he was doing. But it was kind of like JP and Douglas that convinced me, because I mean, I was just starting, so I was willing to do anything to get my name out there and trying to build my reputation and build my career. So we ended up going to that shoot, and I got hurt pretty bad the second day because I overshot a jump doing a switch backflip and dislocated both shoulders at the same time for the first time. And I remember feeling so awkward because both shoulders were out, and then the left one came back in after maybe 10 seconds, but the right shoulder was out, and I could tell something was definitely wrong with it. And I had to go and get it, put it back in, and that's pretty much, that was the beginning of like the problems that I had with my shoulders.
Was this propaganda year? Was this 2001?
No, that would be 13.
Holy shit. Okay. Yeah. Fuck. So you dealt with that your whole career pretty much.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay.
I managed to figure out, you know, at one point it's like, you kind of like to learn that certain position, the certain movements are going to take that shoulder out. So you kind of like protect yourself. So every time I was falling, instead of trying to save myself with putting my hand on the ground, especially going backward, because the upward movement is what got my shoulder out all the time. So I would take the impact right on my shoulder and, you know, braise it as hard as I could on the ground. And lucky for me, I have a pretty strong collarbones, because I mean, that was the impact was always basically on my collarbone all the time.
It all makes sense now on your crash shots.
Yeah.
Intro. Like, cause I like, yeah, you always take it like a football drop in your shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the way.
So how many times in your career did you dislocate your shoulders after that?
I stopped counting, man. Probably 30, 40 times. The worst, but one that really kind of pissed me off was in Vail 2001 US Open half pipe. I was qualified first for the final in the pipe, and on the second hit, I was doing a right side hit Japan and then a mute, you know, usually 12 feet out of the pipe on the second hit, and then into a cork 9. And I went a little bigger and a little quicker than I thought on the lift on the wall on the left side. And when I did my mute, I sort of had to do a move because I was off balance and dislocated my shoulder in the air. And I landed and then stopped in the middle of the pipe and tried to put it back in because it was out. And everybody was like, and I have a mini DV shot of JP's at the bottom of the pipe filming me. And he's like, what the fuck you doing, dude? What the fuck you doing? And I'm trying to put my shoulder back in. And finally had to ski down the pipe. And it took me half an hour to put it back in.
I just want to say right now how dope you are on top of every. I thought how dope you are because you had to do your whole ski style. Like, the reason why I say Phil is so awesome is Casabon, the 20th Phil. It's so awesome because he knows how to fall, right? And yeah. It has a lot to do how you, like, your air awareness moving your body. Yeah. And you eliminated so many opportunities of saving yourself because you couldn't put yourself in that body position.
Yeah.
So big up yourself, man, on being able to even survive by not doing what your body's supposed to do.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
It was definitely always in the back of my mind every time I would hit a jump. Obviously, the feeling of that was the year, that year in Vail. That's the year that I dislocated the shoulder in the final. And it sucks because I probably would have won that that pipe contest because I was boosting bigger than everyone else, and I had the big cork 9 on the right wall. That was pretty good for that year, and I ended up not making the final run because of my shoulder.
And outside of the double blowout shoulder at the Warren Miller shoot, like, any special privilege, like champagne, bubble bats, shrimp, lobster, snacks,
what was actually
included in that whole experience?
That's funny you mentioned it because we had, it was pretty cool. We had Warren Miller always had a star, you know, set up for us. And we had a chef on the ski hill. And when I popped my shoulder out, Max Burke, which was the producer, took me to the infirmary. They popped my shoulder back in. And Max, like, you know what? If you need anything, I can upgrade your room. I can send you room service. I can do whatever. And I'm like, nah, I'm fine, man. I'm, you know, just maybe a 6-pack of beers, and I'll be okay. But they were unrolling the red carpet every time we did anything for them. So that was pretty cool, though.
Epic. Did you guys get compensated for just being stuntmen at that event?
It was actually pretty good. I can't remember exactly how much we were getting paid, but we definitely got paid for every day that we were out there on the hill skiing. And I remember that it was pretty decent for that time. And it was, like I said, it was 5-star plane tickets, everything paid, room, the shuttle from the airport to Breckenridge, and
a little different than making a movie with Johnny.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Johnny always kind of like,
and I don't mean to single movie. I don't mean to single Johnny out. I'm just saying making a movie, because you could say making a movie with me too, right?
Four boys, you know, had their name for themselves pretty good back then, because we didn't get the whole enchilada, like they say, but we managed to, you know, to live pretty good, decent. Johnny had some pretty good hookups with stuff, but I'd say back then MSP had it pretty dialed as well as accommodations. And, you know, we'd go up to Whistler, Susan Darch back then was hooking us up with some condos and, you know, matchstick.
But Warren Miller was the only company that paid day rate.
Oh yeah.
Still one said, like, so that's why it was one said and done. It's like, no way someone's going to pay me. It's just not realistic if you're a ski filmer, athlete.
And it's for us, I mean, you know, it's not like that anymore, but back then, shooting for companies like that, I mean, our sponsors would sponsor the movie to showcase us. So, you know, that basically how it works. What you were getting yearly was including the fact that you were going to do a decent segment, you know, and be in the popular movies. But you know, we back then we would work a full year trying to get a decent segment out there. And nowadays, I mean, you got, you know, at any time you do something cool, it's on the internet right away. And then the next day you have to reinvent yourself. You know, it's like, all right, people have seen this and what's next, you know? So it's very,
I think. And if you don't do it every day, you're forgotten about.
Yeah. You're, and you know, that's funny because I still talk with Alexi Gudbu and, you know, he's from my hometown and I just did something with him in Douglas, right after Christmas. And, you know, these guys even keep, like, I didn't know that, but these guys, even if they get hurt, they'll keep shots that they'll keep posting, even if they're hurt, just to try to, you know, stay out there and people don't know that they're hurt. But, you know, like, oh, I did this today and blah, blah, blah. And just to keep it fresh, trying to stay in the loop. So it's definitely a different game now with Instagram and all that stuff. You know, it's probably a lot harder.
And yeah. So through it all, who's supporting you as far as like outside of yourself, you believe in yourself, anybody giving you help to deal these contract with sponsorship, or are you the manager of your career at that point and athlete on and on?
I always did it myself, which, you know, maybe a bad thing. I could have made it maybe more cash faster, but personally, I like to do it. I thought it was challenging and, you know, having a comparable, all the other guys, like we basically knew how much everybody was making in the industry. So it wasn't too hard to do, but you definitely had to, you know, stand for yourself and be, have the arguments. And, you know, the first contract I signed with Oakley.
Can I stop quick? You're the first person head to toe ever on Oakley outerwear, right?
Yeah, I was the first.
All right, so big up yourself on that, Philippe.
I was the first athlete every sport to be sponsored by Oakley Apparel. And I remember it was in Whistler during right before WSI, which I won that year. And Pat Mack was there with Greg Strokes and Pierre Martin, which was a Canadian guy, and we had dinner at Trattoria. And that dinner was for my segment, for my contract negotiating. And I remember they gave me a price and I was like, I was eating my steak and I was like, well, you guys gonna have to double that. And I was like,
and were you serious or were you sarcastic?
No, I did. I was awesome. Completely serious because they were trying to sign me for both eyewear and apparel.
Yeah, and outerwear.
You know,
street clothes and outerwear.
Yeah, I was winning. You know, I was on the podium of pretty much every competition that I was entering back then, and I was doing pretty good. My segments were good, and I knew what my value was compared to the other guys. So, and that maybe would help me a little bit because JF and Vinny and JP, these guys were always signing their contract a little bit in front before me, and we were all wide open because we knew that if someone was offered more, we could get more. And there wasn't no rivalry in that. We were always kind of like using, how much did you get? Okay, that much. Perfect. So I can get maybe a little less than, or a little more, or whatever the case might be. But I remember when the Oakley said, we're going to give you this amount of money. And I was like, nope, you guys are going to help that to make it interesting. It's like, I already have offer from Spider and then Dragon one, not Dragon, but Smith was interested, but I really wanted to be on Oakley. I didn't want to be on anybody else, but I kind of used that as a leverage. And then I remember Strokes and these guys did a little get together and they were talking, and then Pat Mack said, all right, Phil, you got it. We'll sign you 2 years for that amount. And I was like, all right. I came back to the hotel and I was stoked. I was like, I told Vinny and JF, I was like, let's go out, boys.
Let me ask you, has a negotiation ever gone so easy since that one in your life?
No, probably not. The Salomon first contract was the easiest ever because Lionel came to me. We were in France and I was willing to, I asked him for a little less than the boys because I was the new guy and I was like, I knew these guys were making X amount of money. And I was like, you know, I'll accept. I pitched them with an amount that was a little less than these guys. And he was like, no fucking way, man. I'm giving you the same amount as the boys. You're part of the team. And I was like, all right,
Yeah, that did go better than planned.
That was the easiest one ever. I actually didn't have to negotiate. They upgraded me without me asking. So, yeah, that was definitely the best, the easiest one.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And as we move on, trotting on through the years, like, what starts to mark the end in your mind to your career? Like, how do you foresee the end coming? And are you prepared for the transition?
This will set you up for it. How did you end with Solomon?
How what?
How did it end with Solomon? Because it was a very unique dismantle, right? JF and JP go to Armada.
Yeah.
And so, like, where are you at in this whole picture? And what's your, like, how does that end?
It's actually a pretty good story because I negotiated with Bruno a 2-year contract in 2002 for 2001 and 2002. And he brought me the contract right before the X game in 2001. And it was only a one year contract. And I said to Bruno, I was like, you guys did a mistake. It's supposed to be 2 years. And I had a $5,000 upgrade on the second year.
And this was the day before X Games.
Kind of like the day before X Game. And I had a pretty good incentive on X Game and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, all right, I'll sign this. But I have your words that you'll send me the 2-year contract and we'll negotiate, you know, we'll switch that one. He was like, yeah, no problem. So I signed the contract, did the competition, did okay, but didn't podium. And then the next fall, I'm with Vinny. We're going to Diableret for the early season camp. And that's 2002. Well,
yeah.
Fall of 2001, 2002 season. And Bruno's like, yeah, come to Switzerland. I got the new contract for next year and blah, blah, blah. So I go there. And then we're at the Diableret. And Bruno tells me he's not going to sign me for the 2002 season. So that's like
mid-November going into
late November season starts. I'm getting dropped. The reason is they basically gave my contract to Candide because that's the year Candide is switching to Solomon.
Yeah, from DSA.
He probably made more money than I was making, but he used part of my money to give to him.
Yeah, because JF and JP also left that year.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was a lot available.
For Candide. Yeah. And Vinny was the only one. CR was getting, you know, CR was right there. And CR was kind of like taking a bit of a chunk. But CR and Candide were like, you know, the two main guys they were focusing on that year. And I remember that really, for me, kind of like left a sour taste in my mouth because I didn't really know what to do. And I gave a few phone calls. I remember calling George Cooper, Arazi, and be like, hey, man, I don't have a ski sponsor. What can I do? Blah, blah, blah. I talked to Leventhal too for line, but we're in November, all the contracts are signed. There's not really any money left. So I'm like, you know, Leventhal sent me a couple pair of skis. And he's like, you know, you can ski on those if you want. And we'll go from there. And that year, I remember 2002 Aspen X game. I got a pair of the Solomon's skis that I painted all black with Oakley stickers. And I went to Colorado 3 weeks before the X game. I stayed at Morrison's place and skied with them almost every day. And trained hard in the pipe and went to Copper, went to Breckenridge and skied the pipe a bunch. And showed up at the X game that year with the gear that I had painted and ended up finishing third in the half pipe. And
this was the very first ever Super Pipe X Games, right? 2002?
Yeah, exactly. And what's his face? Candide finished in fourth. So that was for me. I was really stoked because Candy kind of like took my place on Solomon, and I ended up beating him at the X game. And I remember.
Yeah, I guess I never knew what place he got that year.
He was pretty pissed. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that's the year TR won.
No, Yoon won. LaRose was second. Won.
Yeah.
Yoon. And then you were third. Two yeah. Phils and a Yoon.
I think it was Yoon's first gold medal, actually, at the X.
His only gold medal.
Yeah. And you're right. That's it. So I got third. And right
maybe
after
I'm
that,
wrong. Maybe
Bruno came to see me. Bruno Bertrand came to see me and kind of said, hey, you know what? Maybe we can we could talk about doing something with you. And I was like, you know what? I don't have to do anything with you guys. I know the phone will be calling me soon, and soon enough, Cooper Waite got me a contract with Rossi for a couple of years, and I kind of had a feeling that, you know, my career could keep going at that point. And I got offered the job in 2004. I got offered the job to work as a team manager for Oakley. And the way they sold it to me was pretty good, because they said I could keep skiing, keep competing if I wanted to, but I'd had some sort of an exit for my after career, you know. So for me, it was the best of both worlds. So I got
it. So technically, setting up the position of team manager in Canada, correct?
Yeah,
for you,
exactly.
Okay,
team manager for Canada, and I would be taking care of skiing, mountain biking. And also Olympic sports, so track and field, speed skating, and all that stuff. And I'd be marketing manager for that. So,
damn.
I figured it was, for a guy who didn't go to university, it was a pretty good, pretty decent upgrade.
26 years old, figuring it out corporately.
And, yeah, and they were kind of like putting it on a silver platter for me. But as soon as I started working, I planned myself some trips to go shoot and go do this and that. And then, you know, Pierre was like, hey, you can't do this. You can't do that. You got to be in the office. You got to do this. You got to take care of that. So kind of like it kind of came to a very, very desky job very quick. And that I wasn't ready for at all. At that time, drinking a lot, using drugs, and it just kind of like spiraled down from there, because I wasn't really happy with what I was doing. I wasn't ready for the office job at all. I wanted to be out there with my friends skiing and doing my thing. And I started to realize as well that it was getting harder and harder to keep up with the kids. And I think
Were you the only one of your friends with a corporate credit card from one of your sponsors?
Yes, I was.
Like, I was just thinking about that, man.
And remember that all my friends were, you know, were Oakley riders, JP, JF.
You got to take care of them.
Yeah, I have to.
That's a tough position for a 26-year-old, man.
Yeah, man. So I got really out of shape quick, man. I wasn't skiing as much. I was, you know, drinking, partying. If it's during the winter, it was the ski boys, and then in the summer, I met my nemesis, the MTB guys, all the mountain bike guys are basically just like us, just partying their asses off and just riding their bikes. So I fit in the crowd really well and got really drunk and did a lot of drugs with them, and it was really, really dark. At that time, it wasn't that dark, but it became dark really quick, because I wasn't taking care of myself, and Oakley obviously saw that. And, you know, I wished, thinking about it, I wish that they would have got me help instead of dropping me the way they did, because I was really, really in a dark place. And it was really hard to accept the fact that they, you know, they laid me off and I was now by myself, nothing.
So were you only a team manager for Oakley, or did you have a contract as an athlete at the same time?
No, I didn't have a contract as an athlete, but I still had the contract from Rossi. I was still getting paid for gloves as well from Tobert. I was still getting paid by the Caribou, and I still had some money, but it was definitely really, really hard for me to keep skiing, because I never wanted to be the guy that's just like pulling the rubber band till it snaps, you know.
Yeah.
And the day that I shot with for 1242 with Pep in Sonora. In California, and I saw him land all those crazy tricks backward in the powder, and I was like, that's basically the day that I said, it's over, man. I can't do that shit. And I tried landing backwards in the POW with the equipment that I had, and it just didn't work, you know.
That day was unfair for anyone in skiing, and you had to live it in real life.
Yeah.
Because he did what you said. He spun 540s both ways.
Yeah.
Not only did he spin both ways, but then he did the shit in the POW.
Yeah. And I basically, when he did the right side, the left side 540 in the POW, and he came to me at the bottom, and I was like, dude, that was epic. He's like, can you do it wrong? Can you do it right side? And he's like, sure. But, you know, I just did one. It's like, I'm like, do one on the right side and then ask Johnny to edit it both ways back to back. And he went back up and did it to the right side. And I was like, that's it, man. My career is done. I'm not going to be able to keep up. And that's the thing. Like I said, I didn't want to be the guy to try to reinvent myself and became someone I wasn't, you know. Like, for me, it was important to always bring something fresh to skiing. And even though I thought I was ready, I wasn't ready at all to quit, but I was like, the day that I'm not able to do that is the day that I walk away. And, you know, I ended up walking away in a bitter way, but it was, that was it. I couldn't do it professionally anymore.
Spinning around back. I know I brought us down this rabbit hole, but you just mentioned Pep spinning both ways, and yourself was a big proponent of spinning both ways early in your career. And you're also the first one to do back-to-back nines in the pipe, seen in video.
Yep.
And I think we breezed over that.
Yeah, we did breeze over it too much because it is so epic.
Yeah, well, and it's that trick to the right side. Like, I've landed some way better ones, but Johnny only had that shot. But I've learned that trick the morning of that practice because – I wanted something new in my run, and I was like, I'll do right side 900. And I remember Dave Crichton said, dude, it's like, there's no way you can do nine. Cause I was trying it and ended up doing a 720 and kind of skied out of it. And I was like, if I keep it tucked a little more, I can take it to nine. And it felt so awkward, to be honest with you, the first time I tried it, and did a couple and ended up landing it. So I did it three times in my run. And I didn't, to be honest with you, I got third in that competition, but I don't think
people
didn't realize how technical that those back-to-back tricks were for that time. Jordan Monk won. He had an okay run, but I think the
I was thinking Tuffelmeyer won with three hits.
Yeah. And that's the year that they did the best trick, and Crichton was doing the flat spin. I don't know how high
it was. To the moon.
Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah.
Yeah,
back-to-back nines, man. As a fan,
big up for that.
Like, it was just the dopest thing. Because I want to say this, too. Like, if we look at competition, the next guy to do a right side nine on the left wall was probably Tanner in, like, 2008. Like, so that's crazy. That's almost 7 years. I can't think of another guy doing right side nines on the left wall.
I don't know. I think there's maybe some of the French guys, Kevin and these guys maybe, but I think that's after.
That's after.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Much, much after.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know, you're just so far ahead as that idea. But it was an interesting time period because, you know, like, say, Rex, when he'd do, like, Misty Flip, right side Misty Flip nine, same year that you were doing the quarter pipe shit. And, like, he's like, well, I spun to the right. But still judging, you weren't going to be judged on natural. It still had to look perfect. So you're going to be judged on your...
And
so that's why no one wanted to progress the sport in their unnatural side, because it was going to be... They knew they couldn't do it as good as whatever they did to their natural.
And I remember having that argument as well with CR 1 year, because at the US Open, CR was doing under flip five on the right. Yeah. And... it wasn't perfect, but he did it pretty good in the qualifier, but we didn't score him well. And because that year at the US Open, I was judging, and it was duels. So guys were going, and then you'd have to choose which one did it better to move on to a different, to the next round. And I remember CR came to me. He's like, dude, it's like, how come you guys, you know, I did an unnatural 540. And I was like, CR, it's like, can you do it to the left? And he said, was like, you're doing an underflip to the right, but can you do it left? And he's like, I think so. I was like, if you've learned it the first time through your right side is your natural way.
It is fun when people have those little things like what foot was forward. Like Tanner was a left foot forward.
Yeah.
Most people are right foot forward when sliding rails.
So I figured, so you know, if you learn a trick the first time on one direction, it should be your natural way to do it, even though you're spinning the opposite. So, I mean, that's another reason why I said, if you want people to judge you accordingly, do it one side and then do the other one, you know, right after, or in the same movie clip, or do it in the practice, or
a slope style jump back to back, or the half pipe walls back to back.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, if you do it on the pipe, obviously you can't really complain, or you can't say that you can't do it, you know. And it's the same thing, you know. In my segment, sometimes I do a rail right foot forward, and then right after that, I do it left foot forward. And there you go.
Ice, cold, feel it. Song is big.
Oh, man.
Elliot got music rights on that shit.
I miss that kid.
Yeah. Big up CR. Fucking C-Buds. Fucking Shane, man. Nah. Dope-ass humans. Fucking JP. We're hitting them all, though.
Sarah.
Sarah, we'll get on to her.
Yeah.
We're fucking Furburger.
Yeah, man.
All of them.
Yeah, there you
go. Sliding rails in the street both ways before it was a goddamn thing. And
I remember JF was so pissed on that rail because it took me about, I think it took me like probably 6 or 7 tries to get it right foot forward, and then it took me 2 tries to get it left foot forward. And JP couldn't even get JF couldn't even get it on his right foot forward, and he was like, dude. He was sliding, and I told him, I was like, dude, you know what? Don't even bother doing it, dude. It's like, I got both directions. Even if you put it in your segment, the right foot forward, it's not going to get, not going to be as cool. He's like, fuck that.
It's not going to be dope in mine.
So cool. And speaking of street skiing, I think one of your protégés, which was a huge influence for street skiing himself, is Frank Ramon. We'll probably learn from you. Can you speak on that? Like,
Frank, man, he was definitely one of the good street skier back then, man. He was he was doing very technical stuff, and he was very hungry for you know, to shoot and do different things. He would call me up and say, ask me about some rails that, you know, if I thought that was possible and this and that. And He was definitely a cool kid, which I don't see as much as I was, but he's back in, he lived in Vegas for a while. Now he's back. Apparently he's back here. So chances are I'll probably ride my mountain bike with him because he's really into that as well. But, Frank was, definitely, one of the good skiers for rails. And you remember, I'm sure you do, when we went to Mammoth for the Arage, and, I built that team with Frank, you, and the boys, and that was pretty cool. That was a pretty good comp, pretty fun, and I believe that's the year that you broke your collarbone as well.
That's right.
That setup.
How many good memories from 2004?
Yeah.
Yeah.
2004.
Yeah, we also killed. We talked with Mikel, and I made a video that day because I was a 20 or a day make video. So yeah. I had Mikel just killing everyone. So Phil was one of the shots we used where Mikel shot and killed him in the video edit.
Yeah. And
I remember I was scary. Your collarbone was almost sticking out of your skin.
That's right. Yeah, you were kicking cash. You were the cash giver.
Yeah.
JF was fucking on fire.
Yeah.
But, being in Mammoth earlier, Rory Silva sent me a message and he told me, Falou's the reason why I kept skiing. When I saw him at Super Park, I was inspired by his style. Like, I guess also your like presence on skis is like titanic. You're a big man and stylish, and even Mike LaRoche pointed it out in the comments. Like,
Roachies on
you. There's not many people that can make it happen like you do. Like, be tall and big. Like, have a big stature and still make it, like, look so damn smooth.
Yeah, dude. You made it look dope. Like,
it's definitely... Being bigger for sure makes it harder, because everything, every arm wave, everything's going to be more visible, you know? So it's definitely a little harder to make it look good. I mean, for taller guys, I always was a bit of a technician in a way that I'd watch stuff and be like, ah, I didn't like the position of my arm on that. And, you know, you can tell, you know, as well, when you do something flawless, it's, no arm waves, no nothing. It feels great. And there's shots that I've put in my segments against my will, because I didn't like exactly the way they look, but I needed to fill in some segments and I needed the shot. And Johnny even put shots after I said I didn't want him, but he's like, hey, you know, you have to put that. It's cool. So it's, I always been really, really tough on myself. And I think it's the reason why, you know, I worked really hard when I was building my segments and trying to make it look even better than as much as I could. But it's, being a big guy, you fall hard. It's, the jumps are, you know, you got to spin a little quicker sometimes to make it around, but you know, it got me being bigger than everyone else also helps with the ladies, you know? They like the big guys. Vinny never got some love because he was so small, you know? He had a great style, but
when it came what good did it do him off the ski hill, really?
When it came in to walking to the bars and trying to order drinks, Vinny was the worst.
True. Yeah, man. So good. Yeah, it shows in your footage so much how style-orientated your focus was. And that's the reason why it stuck out to me in the first place in your segment in the game. Like, and you can tell, like, your influence is also from skateboarding and snowboarding. And I feel like that shows off. Also, got to send a shout to Yannick B, who's been in the comments.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't see what Yannick wrote, but that was Yannick was always always one of the guys that I like to ski with. And he was very, very close to JP as well, and just an overall great guy, man. I love Yannick, and I don't see him as much as I'd like to, but
he's American. He's
out there killing it.
American Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, man.
What else we got?
Oh, no. So we went over his awesomeness on first tricks. Went over his awesomeness, the biggest tall guy. First Oakley guy, fucking man. I think we've said about how awesome he is. Segments. I got nothing else other than saying you're a cool guy, Falu. Want to say my last thing is big up yourself on being sober, because yeah. Once said and done, like, we praise you and all the other shit that's skiing, but as a friend that's seen the ski friends go through it all. Like, it's the biggest thing. So, like, I just want to big you up on that, man, for figuring that out, because it's bigger than skiing. So, proud of you.
Thanks, man. And I know there's, you know, there's probably guys out there that are struggling and wondering if they can get a grasp back on their life. But it's for me, it definitely was a life changer. And I don't regret the good years. Like, we had a lot of fun, and it was great while it lasted. But it just got to a point where I lost control and, you know, needed to get in control again. So it was hard the first few months, but, you know, I turned the page and it felt so great after 6-7 months, and I never looked back. So 13 years now. So
my longest walk home and coldest was with you from East to West Vale once. So thanks for that, buddy.
I always hated the way that village was designed, man. There's a party on the other side and you live on the other side and you have to, oh man,
the bus ain't running when the party's over.
Yeah, man.
Big up Falu for everything you've done for skiing, man. And also, just like as Iberg said, being sober, but also transitioning to so much and being like a superstar, crashed ice on skates, and then transitioning to having a bike shop, you have done it all and even was a park ranger top tier for Tremblant. And the ski community owes you a lot. And also in general, people, just I'm inspired by what you've done. And thanks for jumping on. And thanks to the crowd for listening. If anybody got some last minute questions for Falu, we're not going to be taking too much of his time because he's a working man. But please, in the comment, showcase your love. I know Yannick, Michael Roche, B-Paul, Rory's been showing love. So everybody, thank you.
Yeah, man. And I got to say, Phil, keep doing your thing, man. I love what you're doing. It's very, very inspiring to see that there's, you know, there's guys out there that are still pushing the sport to a direction that I like to see it going. And it's very, very, very cool to see that there's guys out there that are, you know, really, really into it still. And it's more than crazy to realize where it is now. And I'm just happy every time I look at you, you guys, what you guys are doing. And it's very awesome, man. I wish I could still be in the game, but it's cool to see where skiing's at now.
You're right in the game with us right now, man. Thank you so much.
We're about 4 kilometers from the hill. We specialize in, you know, everything from repairs. We do a lot of rentals as well, mountain biking, e-bikes, hybrid bikes for the bike path. We're right next to the old railroad, which is now a bicycle path. And yeah, we do sell bikes. It's not our core business, but we do have some bikes for sale, and it's been a tough couple of years with supplies, but we can find something for you if needed be.
Wicked stuff, man. Thank you so much once again, Falu. We'll let you get back to your occupation, and much love. Cheers.
Same here, guys.
Take care, Falu.
Good talking to you, Iberg. See you guys.
You too. Peace. Ciao.
Yes, everybody, I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with the legend, the one and only style titan, Falu Poirier, and of course, the Slick Rick of skiing right here with me, Eric Heiberg.
And B-Dawg. Yeah, that was awesome, man. Give thanks, Falu, again.
Wow, man.
Who are we going to do next week? This is fun. Thank you for anyone who listened to this for an hour and a half. Plus, like, give thanks. We enjoy this shit. Rory Silva's on this bitch. So, yeah, it's just my excuse to talk with ski friends. Fucking make sure people maybe get to learn about them, how awesome they are in our world. See what books we got in the mail today. They better not have lost shit. But, yeah. So, that's why we do it. So, I don't know if we're going to be next week. Phil's going on a journey. He's going on a trip.
Yo, but everybody, please let us know who you'd like to see, even if we're not short of inspiration to do, but we'd love to have your take on it. So anybody in the comment section, hit us on messages, tell us who you want to see next. And until
we're gonna get like Greg Tuffelmeier for sure. I want to get Johnny Cesare. I want to get who else? Chris Osnes, I think I said. We know we gotta get Vinny, and we gotta get JF. We gotta get the three Phils. There's so many people, man. So many people. We can do this. We're gonna be doing this all the time. This is my weekly ski talk. So fuck yeah. Phil's going to Sweden. Frank Raymond, I don't know if you're on here. Big up yourself. I gotta find this video and send it to you, man. Have I sent you the dancing Frank Raymond video?
Nope, I have not. Okay. Seen this.
I will show it to you. It's amazing. It's out there, man. Everyone knows about him. So thanks for everyone who's watching.
Yeah, you guys are the shit. B-Paul. Peace, Yannick, Mike LaRoche, Rory, everybody that jumped in, the fans, much love. And until next time on Giving Flowers 2.
Have a wonderful Wednesday. Peace.